namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Continuing part two of discussion on Canto 2, Chapter 9, Text 34, the second of the Chaturshloki verses. I'm going to read, for starters, from Under His Lotus Feet. This is Bhojan Prabhu's text that gathers comments from Chaitanya Charitamrita and other places and summarizes on this important verse. So I'll begin with a paragraph that reads, "That which appears to be separate or independent appears as such only due to the Lord's illusory energy Maya, which is also supported by and rests in Him." So that connects with the first of the Chaturshloki verses. Everything that exists, including Maya, exists because it's supported by and rests in Him. Nothing exists but Him and His energies. And the feature of Maya is something appears to be not like that. It appears to be separate or independent. Or we think of ourselves as separate or independent. So that's Maya, the Lord's illusory energy. Next sentence says that Krishna is beyond Maya. He's in another realm, another dimension. Bhojan writes, "Yet the Lord Himself, as well as His qualities, pastimes, and associates, are fully transcendental beyond Maya's realm. Those in Maya's grip, however, will perceive the Lord as if He too were within Maya." Like Ranikashipu saw Lord Srinadev, or like Kamsa saw Krishna. Although he had knowledge, Kamsa had knowledge, Hiranyakashipu exhibited his transcendental knowledge when he pacified the relatives, Diti and other relatives, at the death of his brother. He had transcendental knowledge. And yet, transcendental knowledge has its limits. Transcendental knowledge may be understanding the soul is eternal, but not understanding the Supreme from whom the soul comes and under whom the soul is ordered or directed. Because his next idea was that he would kill Vishnu, as if Vishnu is within the realm of Maya. And that's the nature of somebody who's in Maya. That which is transcendental, they can't recognize. Conversely, those who are free from Maya can perceive Krishna as an entity separate from Maya. Like the discussion yesterday, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur saying, the cloth and the pot, when there's the lamp in the room, you can see them. You take the lamp out of the room. Same room, same cloth, same pot, you can't see them. It's as if they don't exist. And one goes on in that mind center, that sense of reality, that which exists doesn't exist, because one can't perceive it. It is impossible for those suffering from material illusion to know and love the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, one should give up illusion. That's nice. Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Leela, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has outlined the Chaturshloki verses. Here they are. They're in Madhya 25:116, 17, 18, and 19. In four verses, he summarizes this one verse, or expands, as follows. Actual spiritual knowledge and its practical application are considered in all of these sound vibrations. That's, you know, the four essential Srimad Bhagavatam verses, that the four Chaturshloki verses, the sound vibrations of them, are actual spiritual knowledge and the application, practical application of that actual spiritual knowledge. They're considered in these four verses. Although the external energy comes from me, I am different from it. Sometimes a reflection of the sun is experienced in a place of the sun. A reflection of the sun is experienced in place of the sun, but its illumination is never possible independent of the sun. When one is transcendentally situated, he can perceive me. This perception is the basis of one's relationship with the Supreme Lord. Let me now further explain this subject matter. What appears to be truth without me is certainly my illusory energy. For nothing can exist without me. It is like the reflection of a real light in the shadows, for in the light there are neither shadows nor reflections. So darkness means not only the absence of light, but even the absence of reflections. So when there is a reflection that makes something look like that's real, Rabindra recalls it like a little slice of truth. But that's actually even a little, it's just a reflection. Like religions are made of, they have a little sliver of the whole picture of reality, and their religion is based upon that. But what here is describing is that even that sliver and the religion based upon that sliver, that truth or reality that somebody has a hold of and resonate with, without the picture of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, without acknowledging and recognizing and even seeing, knowing the personality of Godhead, then it's but a reflection of the full thing, or real knowledge. Writes that Srila Sridhar Swami has commented that this verse describes darkness, the power of the Lord's illusion. So, referring again to Vyasadeva's realization, Vyasadeva had that realization also. How the feature of Maya, under the Lord's full control, acts to bewilder the living entity, and the nature of that bewilderment is the living entity completely forgets who he is, who God is, what's real, what's illusion, and begins accepting another reality as reality. So one, there's two dimensions of this. One is accepting things that are not real to be real. And then there's accepting those things that are real to be not real. You know, knowledge in the mode of ignorance. What is to be done is not to be done, and vice versa. In Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, it's very amazing, very detailed, like, and very deep. He is describing the distinction between, previously, we discussed yesterday, vidya and avidya. Vidya is like light and avidya is darkness. So here he is discussing vidya as transcendental knowledge and sattva-guna vidya, or knowledge that's mixed with the modes of nature, even the mode of goodness. And so there's realization of atma, but not full disclosure of Paramatma and Bhagavan. There's realization of Paramatma without full realization of Bhagavan, and full realization of Bhagavan. So the gloss is, it's only by pure devotion can Krishna be known in his personal feature. But by vidya in the quality of goodness, the Atma can be realized, but not Paramatma. And by vidya that's mixed with bhakti, one can realize Paramatma, but not Bhagavan. And only by pure bhakti can one realize Bhagavan. He gives the example, like we were discussing yesterday evening, about, I think in the end of the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna shows his universal form. Arjuna requests Krishna, please take away this universal form and show me your personal form. And he shows Vishnu form, or Paramatma, he says here. And then he shows his personal form, Bhagavan, and says, only by pure devotion can I be actually seen. And he's making the comment by example that when Kamsa sees Krishna, it's by Krishna's kindness that he sees Kamsa, but Kamsa doesn't see Bhagavan. He sees a powerful person. It's specifically mentioned like that also in relation to Ravana and Hiranyakashipu. Why they didn't go back to Godhead, it's part of the Lord's plan, but they were seeing, like Ravana thought, Ram is a powerful mystic like me, but I'm invincibly powerful. He's mortal. And Hiranyakashipu thought, so right in the purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Hiranyakashipu thought, look at this form. This is a being with great mystic powers, but who can surpass my mystic powers? So when he was killed, he was thinking, a living entity with mystic powers like me. Although he was in the direct presence of the personality of Godhead. And Kamsa, you know, fear personified was Krishna, because it meant his death. And Shishupal, same. So, one may see Krishna, that's someone who is covered by avidya, or even by the agency of Krishna's mercy, one can see Krishna but not have the proper understanding. So it's only by real vidya is pure devotion. That's the conclusion. And anything other than pure devotion will lead to a covering of the cloth and the pot, or Bhagavan, Krishna. So there's degrees, in other words. Here's how he writes. By vidya, the jiva realizes that he is atma. He does not realize paramatma, or tat, by vidya, which is in sattva guna. Because the Lord is beyond the gunas, he realizes the Lord only by pure bhakti, which is beyond the gunas. For the Lord says, bhaktyaham ekaya graya. I am achieved only by bhakti. We mentioned this yesterday. This is a Uddhava Gita verse, 11th canto, Bhagavatam. I am achieved only by bhakti. Knowledge or jnana can give liberation. And that knowledge or jnana which can give liberation springs from the quality of goodness. But one can't realize paramatma, because paramatma is beyond the gunas. So by speculative method, one isn't going to get paramatma realization. Whatever the idea they may contemplate about paramatma, it just immediately falls to Brahman conception. So therefore their whole rationale, whatever it is, this may be a means to get to the position of oneness, because they can't enter beyond that position of oneness. They can't see the distinctions. They can't see the pot and they can't see the cloth, because of the influence of avidya. Even its knowledge, still influenced by the modes of nature, sattva guna. He supports this by the following verse from 11th canto. 11:25, text number 30. Therefore, material substance, place, result of activity, time, knowledge, work, the performer of work, faith, state of consciousness, species of life, and destination after life are all based on the three modes of material nature. The living entity who conquers these modes manifested from the mind can dedicate himself to me by the process of devotional service and thus attain pure love for me. His point after this quote is, devotional service needs to be regularly performed, because devotional service that's initially performed still has some influence of modes. And because of the influence of the modes, one can't see Krishna. But if one continuously, regularly, carefully, repeatedly performs bhakti, then gradually realization of Krishna becomes possible. That's because the power of bhakti is it dissolves the modes of nature, the influence of the modes of nature. Dissolves avidya, or just like light, by gradually increasing the intensity of light, darkness is further and further dispelled, and as darkness is further and further dispelled, the details of reality, or using his metaphor, what's in the room, becomes discernible. First to Bhagavad Gita, the Brahmabhuta Prasanatma verse, 1854. Having attained the state of Brahman, Brahmabhuta, being a pure soul, he does not lament in loss of what he had, nor does he desire what he does not have, and looks upon all beings as equal. He then manifests pure bhakti. So, this is the way what he's providing is a description of how the illusion is dismissed by the process of bhakti. And it's gradual. He writes, by bhakti alone all suffering, including avidya, is destroyed. Kapila Dev expresses the same to Devahuti by saying not only the modes of nature are destroyed and avidya is destroyed, the subtle body of the living entity becomes dissolved. Without separate effort through bhakti. By that bhakti alone, a person will realize directly Bhagavan, filled with bliss and knowledge, just as a person with strong eyesight, by good fortune, can see the general form of the beautiful deity and also the details of the face, nose, eyes, and ears. This purport is just like amazing. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is amazing. He takes what this topic and starts going into the pastimes of Krishna and showing how first the fundamental understanding is that Mahamaya is an expansion of Yoga Maya. Just like in the pastime with Krishna instructing Yoga Maya to transfer Balaram into the womb of Rohini from the womb of Devaki. And after she then does that, she takes birth in the, or takes shelter in the womb of Mother Yasoda, and then is transferred after her birth to the prison house of Kamsa, and then she becomes Durga. So Yogamaya, by expansion, becomes Durga. But it's Durga is but an expansion of Yogamaya. Here he's using the phrase vibhuti. Just like last night in the class, yesterday afternoon in the class, I was asking, what are verses from Bhagavad Gita where we can understand that Krishna is the source of everything? Examples. So one of those examples Kirtita gave was the whole of the 10th chapter where Krishna is describing his vibhutis. The vibhutis are material manifestations that come but from Krishna. So here Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying something very similar. Mahamaya is a vibhuti of Krishna's internal potency. Rather than giving specific examples, it's a general statement. Mahamaya is a vibhuti of Yogamaya. It's but an expansion of Yogamaya. And so Yogamaya has a variety of expansions, not just Mahamaya. There are ways like Mahamaya acts to bewilder, or say to cover and obscure things. Yogamaya also does the same even with Krishna's pure devotees. So he goes through looking inside Mother Jasoda, looking inside Krishna's mouth. He describes the Brahma Vimohan Leela. He describes the Mother Jasoda's being unable to bind Krishna with the Damodar Leela. Krishna's manifesting simultaneous forms when he encounters Shutadev and Baharashva, or the queens in Dwaraka. He manifests simultaneous forms, and it's bewildering. By Yoga Maya, he could perform his pastimes in each place by hiding the other form and revealing one form to each party, simultaneously manifesting two different forms for Shrutadev and Baholashva, and hiding one form from each is different from Yogamaya acting upon one person, such as Mother Jashoda. So he's just churning the topic of how Yogamaya can act in so many, and he gives descriptions or like categories of how Yogamaya is differently revealing Krishna and concealing Krishna. So even in pure devotion, that goes on, what to speak of when there's not pure devotion. But when there's pure devotion, each of those incidents is for increasing affection and attachment for Krishna. Like Krishna is coming before Muchukunda. Muchukunda didn't recognize Krishna, that this is the personality of Godhead. And gradually, by Krishna's mercy, by another feature of his internal potency, he realized, this is my worshipful master. Or Jambavan didn't realize Krishna after battling with Krishna for so long. But then finally he had this realization, this is Krishna. I'll read the paragraph where he's speaking about the universal form and Arjuna. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, in order to show how prema is restricted by realization of power, Arjuna realized the universal form and the form of Paramatma when it was revealed by Yogamaya. Because of the covering of Yogamaya, he did not experience the sarupa of Krishna, which was still present, because Krishna was right beside him. Krishna was right beside him. And he's seeing this universal form. Oh, please remove that universal form. Let me see, your original form is right next to him. So then he shows the forearm form. Oh, I want to see your original form. But his original form is right next to him. At other times, he did not experience either the universal form or Paramatma, which was covered by Yogamaya, but experienced Krishna's two-armed form. At one time, one form of the Lord was revealed, while another was covered. So he's relishing the topic that this is a different way than how Krishna was acting with Mother Jasoda, seeing the form of the universe, the entire cosmic manifestation within Krishna's mouth. In order to show that Jasoda's love could not be restricted by a show of Krishna's power, Yogamaya revealed the material universe within his stomach, while simultaneously revealing the spiritual forms of Gokula, Yashoda, and Krishna. Mother Yashoda was simultaneously seeing Krishna and seeing the form of the universe within Krishna. His point is, Yogamaya was acting differently with Arjuna. He could see one form or another form or another form, but by the influence of Yogamaya couldn't see them simultaneously. Mother Yashoda was seeing them simultaneously. And after a moment, did not perceive it, since Yogamaya covered that realization. It's his commentary is fascinating. The essence is that even realization of Krishna is dependent upon Krishna. And which feature of Krishna, to what degree, and what, you know, even for those on the platform of pure bhakti, what they realize about Krishna is dependent upon Krishna's disclosure. And that's the agency of that disclosure is Yogamaya. So, now going way back, what to speak of those that don't have pure bhakti? We'll go back a little bit, and those that have mixed devotion, or those that just have transcendental knowledge and influenced by or touched by the quality of goodness, then they can realize Atma, but they don't have any capacity to realize Paramatma. And their realization is also theoretical. So now we'll go back further and say, those that don't see any connection between matter and the source of matter, they're not going to see spirit. And if whatever there is of a sense of reality or value in matter, and thus eagerly pursue gaining control or possessiveness or enjoying matter, it's his illusory potency. And the illusory potency is a big part of everybody's life. Big part of everybody's life. But then there's a means of going beyond that, or getting out of the clutches of Maya. And that's the linking process of bhakti. So certainly the Chaturshloki verses, they're sequential. The first one is everything comes from Krishna, that because it comes from Krishna, it's inseparable. The next is seeing things separate. That's his illusory potency. Obviously the next one is devotional service, or the linking process from the position of being, of seeing or thinking separately, to again connect. That's coming attractions. But it's already presented in its various stages. So, very, very wonderfully by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his commentary. So what I'm going to do finally is just going to read, this is Bhurijan's summary of, he's taken, there's 10 points, rather than reading Prabhupada's purport, this is the summary of those points found in text 24 purport. 10 points. First one is, Prabhupada summarizes what text 33 and 34 are saying. Quick summary. Then he dismisses Mayavad philosophy. He dismisses Mayavad philosophy by saying, when they say material world is false, it's not false. It's an energy of Krishna, which is resting upon Krishna. The illusion is to think that it exists separately from Krishna, not that it exists. One's tendency to accept something that changes as eternal is an illusion. Eternal or of value. It's having intrinsic value unto itself. Like, you know, enduring value. That's illusion. Instead of thinking of it as having enduring value intrinsically, one should accept it as a reflection of reality. Because that's what it is. This material world is a reflection of the spiritual world. The next point is, those that are influenced by Maya have two main spirits. One is, I'm the Lord of this energy. And the other is, the Lord exists but he's formless. Impersonalism. But the Bhagavatam teaches that both the Lord and the living entity have form eternally. So they're both under the grip of Maya. Maya bodies are under the grip of Maya by thinking that way. Next point is Vedanta Sutra confirms that everything comes from and is connected from the Lord. Same thing as text 33, the first of the chapter, Shloki verses. Everything that exists comes from the Lord and is connected with the Lord. The converse is also true. There's nothing that exists that's separate from the Lord. And since that's true, we, the living entities, are not separate from the Lord. We're connected to the Lord and we're dependent upon him. It's the dazzle, the glare, Prabhupada would call it the glitter gold, the bewildering attractiveness of Maya draws the attention of the living entity away from his factual position of being dependent upon the Lord and thinks otherwise, independent, or even more grossly, God doesn't even exist, all there is matter. World is filled with such people. The final points are, I'll read, a sane man takes enlightenment from the disciplic succession, beginning with Brahma, who was personally instructed by the Lord. A sane man thus knows the Lord's position as the source, maintainer, and annihilator of all that is, and becomes the Lord's pure servant. This means that to get out of Maya, to get out of the grip of illusion, it's not just by our effort. It's by the arrangement of the Lord is one who he has duly enlightened can offer that light and can illumine our darkened condition and reveal the Lord and his position, the source, the maintainer, the proprietor, ultimately even the annihilator, and through that disclosure help one also become pure in devotion, freed from illusion. Next point is a little subtle. The living entities are also of the Lord, although they are not themselves God. So this is, you know, this is a problem for monists. To the degree that they have knowledge and understand their identity is not material, they're not yet making a distinction between the Supreme and themselves. So they think, I am God, because I'm spiritual and not matter. But not so. We're, once again, we're dependent. We're emanations from the Supreme. We're energy of the Supreme. And we're not the Supreme. It's like, you know, confidential knowledge, more confidential knowledge, and most confidential knowledge. The more confidential knowledge is making the distinction between the individual living entity and the Supreme Being. So, impersonalists, through refinement of knowledge in the quality of goodness, can understand to some degree, to a limited degree, their spiritual identity. But then there's a trap, another trap of Maya that says, I am God. Rather than understanding very clear message of Bhagavad Gita, we're an energy of God, of the same quality as Him, but we're not the source of everything. We're from the source of everything, and we have a relationship, a dependent relationship upon the source of everything. Last two points. The material energy is like darkness. The Lord is like light, and the living entities are like the reflection of light and darkness. Nice. Very nice. The presence of the living entity, like a reflection, tells something about the object that's being reflected. The presence of the living entity in his dependent position infers, for a thoughtful person, there is a supreme living entity. A supremely conscious living entity, and like we have qualities of love and happiness and desire, he has these in fullness and perfectly, without any of the imperfections which we're accustomed to in our conditioned state. We're like the reflection, and he is the light, and Maya is the darkness. No one can become free from darkness by the reflected light of the common man. One has to receive the light from the original light itself. Nice point. Reflected light can help to some extent, but the fullness of becoming free from darkness is by being in the presence of the Supreme. Therefore, a qualified person, a qualified teacher, spiritual master, or representative of Krishna, is simply providing directly, not indirectly, but directly, the transcendental knowledge, like Brahma, this prior example of the purport. Krishna enlightened Brahma, and Brahma is simply giving that light of Krishna to others. That's the mystery of disciplic succession that's described in the earlier verses prior to this one. Sarahasyam, the mystery of disciplic succession. When the representative in disciplic succession presents Krishna, Krishna says, Krishna's words, Krishna's mercy, Krishna's message, that's Krishna. Directly. One receives that, so in other words, in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita. And then there's the person who vibrates the Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita, that's Krishna. As opposed to speculative renderings of the same. Finally, all living entities are born in darkness, And the mercy of the Lord, which is light, is required for us to get out of darkness. So essentially, we require descending mercy in our lives. Srimad Bhagavatam is presented for that purpose. It's not just knowledge in the mode of goodness. It's not just to, certainly it's to take us beyond the bodily conception of life. But that's just a beginning. It's actually meant to take us to Krishna. That's the mission. Back to Godhead. And the whole message of Srimad Bhagavatam, similarly, is to take us to Krishna. And these Chaturshloki verses are doing exactly that, very directly. And to reach the position of no longer having shelter in illusory conceptions of life or Maya, we have to know what Maya is. I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday who was describing, you know, a particular feeling of Maya, and they knew that it was a feeling induced by Maya, but, you know, they were identifying with that feeling induced by Maya and saying, what to do? Turn to Krishna. And then there was the yeah, but. So then means one wants to take shelter of Maya. Even we don't want it to the shelter of Maya. We're willingly taking the shelter of Maya. Through sound vibration, through carefully hearing, just as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying, by the regular practice of bhakti, the influence of the modes of nature subsides, and the awakening of knowledge of Krishna gradually enters, the gradual cleansing process. Sometimes it seems too gradual, but the gradual cleansing process. And it depends on how much we're taking, you know, shelter in the so-called happiness of the modes of nature independent of Krishna. But the bhakti process is still very merciful, and by the influence of the internal potency can take us to the other side. And that's what is coming up in the next verse, the linking process of bhakti. Okay. Any discussion? Yeah.
Thank you very much for this class, Maharaj. One question I had was how you were describing that to continually and regularly perform bhakti for the modes to dissolve. And one message I've been repeatedly hearing is to continue the process and not expect or not be focused on the results of the process. But I'm saying, like you're saying, when some things, it's like too gradual, and seeing for years and years I'm not seemingly making any breakthrough, and then it's disheartening. I have faith in the process, but I despair that I'll be able to make it. So I'm not sure how to address myself.
Patience. Recently in Mayapur, all the permits for the Temple of Vedic Planetarium are now secured. It took so many years, but that they now have the permits, and so they're preparing the land for construction. To do that, the engineers said the trees had to be removed. And there was this big uproar. Oh, Prabhupada said, don't cut trees. You know how many years it took to grow those trees? So they did everything they could to, there's procedures for uprooting trees with a certain amount of the roots and then you can replant them elsewhere. But some of them, that was not, it would be too costly. It's possible, but it's too costly. And there's not the all the equipment that exists in the West, in West Bengal to do it. So some of the trees were lost. And then there's grafting and other things that can be done. You can reproduce the tree and however that's done. But to grow the tree, it's 30 years. But the process of growing trees, as it happened 30 years ago, it can happen again. And in another 30 years, that you have another tree of the same stature and size. Everything takes time. To grow another tree, it's going to take some time. But the process of growing trees is the same today as it was 30 years ago. So for ourselves, how long it will take and how much we perceive change, another tree example is they can tell the age of a tree when they cut it by how many rings there are. And when you look at the rings of a tree, I don't know the science, but some are thicker, some are thinner. You know, at different stages and whatever's going on in the atmosphere, sometimes the trees grow faster, sometimes slower. So they can tell how many years old the tree is by how many rings, because each year something, 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 something. And it's a little different of a coloration, so that's how they can tell the rings. Or someone was pointing out to me, we saw some cactuses, they can, you know, how fast a cactus grows. It's like, you know, a quarter of an inch a year. So they have some cactuses that are like 6 feet tall, and then you can tell how old it is. They don't appreciably grow. It's not like, you know, a maple tree or something, you come back 5 years later and it's... But a cactus, it's 5 years later and it's, you know, an inch and a quarter. But the principle of growth is there nonetheless. Whatever the speed is or the rate, the rate of our devotional progress largely is dependent upon how we apply ourselves to the process. Or, say it in reverse, how much we're holding on to our material affinity of one kind or another. Those illusory shelters that we cling to. Maybe you noticed outside the Chicago Temple, you're looking at the altar, and on the right there's all those windows. Towards the front is a big oak tree. And for years, when I first went there, there was this chain that was like, you know, half an inch thick of the rings that were holding a branch because it was growing, you know, so they chained it up so it would grow like this instead of like this, leaning, so it would grow straight. But look now, and the chain is broken. For years, it was growing, 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 and finally, the chain broke. Thick, half inch loops. Broke. Because eventually the growth didn't conform to the force of the chain. The force of the chain was snapped by the growth of the tree. You know, little. Probably what they wanted is now accomplished, because at least it's growing instead of, you know, towards the building that's right to the side. It's growing enough, it's not going to, you know, crush the building by its growth. But little by little by little. So the rate of our advancement in Krishna consciousness depends upon, to a certain degree, it depends upon our past, because of attachment to the past. Our tendencies and shelters and sense of happiness and the modes of nature and so on. Those persons that are perhaps more rapidly than us advancing tells something about their previous lifetimes of spiritual participation and practice and progress. Recently I heard a description of I think it was Yasumati Nandana was describing this. Somebody was describing, maybe it was Hari Sori, somebody was describing this. They were attending a festival somewhere in South India, something like that. And then a group of devotees were going back to Vrindavan to meet with Prabhupada, and along with the group there was one older Indian sadhu, kind of like on the same train. They had, you know, they had several cars and it was packed with devotees, and he was sitting right at the end, practically, you know, where the two cars join. The couple. And he just sat there very quietly the whole time, the whole train ride from South India to Vrindavan. And when they got to Vrindavan, he saw that within a couple of days, Prabhupada had initiated him, and it was Gaura Govinda Maharaj. But, you know, very quickly, just through, because Prabhupada was at the Pandal, and Prabhupada flew back, and they came by train, something like that, that, you know, it was just that little association, but because of his previous devotional service, you know, very quickly, he came to a certain level of performance of devotional service. So, what prior to this lifetime, what devotional service we may have rendered, something can be told by, you know, what level very quickly we come to, and then the progressive progress. So one devotee may advance very quickly in the beginning, as opposed to another devotee that it's more slow. But then from that position, how we go further is depending upon how we apply ourselves. But we may, like that tree with a chain around it, we may not recognize ourselves how we're progressing. But, you know, the chain of, you know, our material identification can, at some point, as you say, have a breakthrough or snap. Just by our continuing spiritual progress. However little, hardly noticeable it may be. But there's still progress because, like you say, the faith is there, but how long? It's whether we're a cactus or a maple tree or a, you know, a weed. That's just, weeds grow very fast. And the building that used to be right next to the Brooklyn Temple, where the deli and all those little shops are, they're now leveled. But the person that was planning to put in a 5-star hotel, there were some violations of how they did certain things to, you know, to do their excavation, this and that and the other thing. So they just filled it in, waiting to get all that gets settled, because they don't want to have a problem with somebody falling into a hole in the ground. So it's just like dirt right outside where that building was. And now there's this, in a period of about, at least, you know, the last time I was in New York, there's a tree, it's just like a weed kind of a tree. It's about 10 feet tall in just a matter of a few months. There are these little guy trees, you know, weeds and things, but there's this one with big, giant leaves. It's about 10 feet tall. By the time I get back, it's probably like 15 feet tall. That's growing very fast. but it's a weed. And it's just going to get knocked down. But, you know, a strong oak tree takes how long? Years and years and years and years and years. So, I would not recommend that you worry about how long it's going to take. I would worry about how carefully I'm following the process. The same message that you repeated at the beginning. Don't worry about the result, worry about how you're following the process. Because by properly following the process, whatever the rate is, there's going to be spiritual growth, spiritual development, spiritual progress. And to connect it with the verse, the influences of avidya and emotive nature and forgetfulness of Krishna, absenteeism in our relationship with Krishna, will gradually be removed and replaced, however gradual that is. So if you want to see the pace increase, apply yourself more to the process than thinking about the result.
That's where I get passionate.
Huh?
I'm trying to apply myself more and get passionate.
Like, you know, your Tulsi tree. It's not like, you know, I'm guessing that you didn't start growing your Tulsi tree thinking, oh, we'd like to have this big, bushy Tulsi tree. You were just taking care of Tulsi, and Tulsi grew that way. Beautiful Tulsi plant. Amazing. But, you know, you didn't start with that end in mind. You started with this worshipping Tulsi, carefully. Same.
Maharaj, you were discussing about how we are dependent I'm finding that I tend to be over dependent. I need somebody to keep telling me that she's doing okay. And when that's not there, then I become very
lost.
Yes, Maharaj. So what is the proper way to be dependent? Just how to internalize these messages and feel dependent on them, not need external validation?
What you described is not dependent. You know, the malady notion. It's not mature, because it's, say, like a child. I've seen children that they become so accustomed to their parents feeding them that even as they get older and older, they can't eat what's on their plate unless their mother puts the food in their mouth. They can, but they won't. So they still want to be, you know, the little baby, although they're not the little baby anymore. They're old enough to, you know, tie their shoes and put their pants on and eat what's on their plate. So it's not exactly dependent, independent. It's maturity, recognizing, you know, this is a service. I put, you know, my mother puts the food in the, you know, and I bit by bit I take it. And then one day I'll go help my mother in the kitchen and help prepare it, not only just eat it. So it's maturity of the role of being a servant. when one is in the role of being a servant, that's what dependency is. I don't act independently. What I do as service is what's given to me or coming down. Independent is I don't pay attention to that, I just do what I want to do. So the mature stage of dependency is not my own notions, but the mature stage of dependency is in the form of service. And so the connection is the instructions and the service that flow from the instructions. So it's a matter of maturity. You can say emotional maturity or spiritual maturity. I take responsibility for taking morsels of food and, you know, I'm feeling grateful that Krishna's provided and the cook has prepared and offered to Krishna, and so now I'm taking. But this is my service. Continuing to nourish myself through this process, the eating process. And then you're dependent in a mature way. Not independent. And not overly dependent, but dependent in a mature way, in a proper way. Yes?
Thank you very much for the class, Maharaj. One thing I noticed they were mentioning, maybe one of the last points, that a member of the disciplic succession, the principle being becoming free from darkness is from the original light.
Yes.
And not from the reflected light.
Yeah.
And that significant point that you made as a corollary was the member of disciplic succession gives us Krishna, not a reflection.
Yeah.
So I was trying to understand how is it that we can discriminate that somebody is presenting Krishna as opposed to a sliver of like a slice of.
Well, you know, it's a question of where does attention go. Here's a classic example that Prabhupada gives is when you're looking for the sun. Do you look for the sun by, you know, pulling back the curtain, or do you look for the sun by using a flashlight? And someone, you know, holds the flashlight and says, "See, here's the sun." You know that person's a cheater. Because that's not how the sun is revealed or disclosed by a flashlight. See, there it is. You know, the sun discloses itself. The position of the one who is transparent is they simply repeat the message of disciplic succession. They don't make some other skewed rendering and say, "Here's God." I was attending a home program with a Bengali family. And like a group of older Bengalis that were there, they're used to hearing scholarly speculators say, "This means that." They're not accustomed to as it is. This means this. So, when at the end of the I took Bhagavad Gita because I thought this is a group that needs to hear something very basic. So I spoke Bhagavad Gita, and at the end, one person raised his hand and said, "Could you give us some different interpretations of what such and such verse in Bhagavad Gita says?" Because that's what they're accustomed to hearing. This interpretation, that interpretation. And he didn't know how to respond to my answer. I said, you know, we don't do that. Someone who does that is a cheater. Let them tell you their own ideas about their own things, but what Krishna says is what Krishna means. And Krishna means what he says. And this is what Krishna says, and that's what it means. So, the interpretation approach is to be avoided or guarded against. Or where the attention does not go to Krishna but to the person. It was one of the comments that was made about Prabhupada at the time of his departure in 1977. One of their appreciations was that he was known as, he's the founder of the Hare Krishna movement, but nobody knew his name until he left the world, and then they had to say, oh, this is his name. Because all they knew was the Hare Krishna movement, because he was disclosing Krishna. But in contrast, they were saying all the other spiritual groups were known by the name of the person who was spreading the group. This one, that one, the other one. They weren't disclosing Krishna, they were pushing themselves and obscuring Krishna. Krishna wasn't in the picture, just like people that translate and make commentary on Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada's complaint is, where's Krishna? He disappears. And this means that. But conversely, the appreciation when Prabhupada would indicate for the Bhakta Godhead